1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And 51551 is our text number. Helena and Gerry O'Connor, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
That's
Helena. Hello, Joe, how are you?
Good. You've contacted us because of a catastrophic tragedy that befell your family in June 2011 when your son Gavin was murdered. What happened, Helena?
Gavin left the house on Friday night, Joe, to go to a music festival in Carrickmacross. He was a musician himself. He went to the festival every year. He socialised in Carrickmacross all the time. Mm-hmm. He left and he never came home. Gavin spent the night with his friends, having a few pints, listening to the different bands. Yeah. At approximately 20 past three, Gavin went back to his car where he had parked. He took off his runners, put them on the front seat and lay down and went to sleep. And approximately an hour later, his car was broken into and driven out. Well, we don't know where the assault took place, but Gavin was consequently assaulted with four rocks while he was sleeping in the back of his car. And then we don't know how he was got out of the car, but he was ran down with his own car.
My God.
And the guy then went to a friend's house, told him what he had done, and asked him would he go up the north with him to burn the car.
This is Connor McClelland.
Connor McClelland. And the guy that he went to rang the Gardaí to report that this guy wanted to go and burn a car and what he had done.
And Helena, I'll talk to you again about the subsequent happenings, but this man, Conor McClendon, was convicted of murder unanimously in the Central Criminal Court, which was sitting in Monaghan on the 18th of February last.
Yes.
It's only a few weeks ago. Why has it, and it's, I know this is one of the reasons you contacted, why has this not got national prominence?
That's what we'd like to know, Joe. Like, there was absolutely no media presence at the trial for such a horrific murder.
And Gerry, you're there as well on the other phone.
Nearly 2.5 weeks. And we went in and out of that courtroom as if we were going in and out of a sweet shop. It's as if nobody knew and nobody cared. And if I could let you know, Joe, what this man did.
Yeah.
This man assaulted Gavin in the back of his car with a rock the size of your fist. To the extent that he probably knocked Gavin out.
Yeah.
He was able to go to the ditch and he took a rock out of the ditch to size your shoe. And he got back into the car and he battered the head of Gavin with the rock to the extent that he lost that rock. He went back to the ditch and he got another rock to size your shoe and he got back into the car and he continued to beat the head of Gavin with the rock till he lost it. He went back to the ditch again and he got a third rock to size your shoe and he bashed the head of Gavin till he lost that rock. He then went for a walk to cool himself off, is what he said. This is what he said.
Yeah.
And when he turned round, he said he seen Gavin standing on the road with his head covered in blood and his hands at his side. He said he got into his car, into Gavin's car, and he drove it at him. And he hit Gavin with such force that he split Gavin's skull in two. It was described as a hinge fracture. He split Gavin's skull in two. That's what this fella done. And nobody in the country knows anything about it. Because we don't know. It's as if we were forgotten. Shocking. This is what he done. The injury to his face was so bad that his eye sockets were smashed. And our boy was a beautiful boy. That's what this fella done.
Connor McClelland. And apparently
he... 5 o'clock in the morning.
And apparently he's... What age is he? He was 22.
He was 19.
19. And he had many previous convictions that he have.
21.
And what were they for, Helena? Do you know?
Some were motoring offences. Some were assault. Some were... No, like, there were a variety of...
Theft, stealing cars and assault.
And this fellow McClelland was obviously on a rampage through his teenage years and ended up with your boy been savagely beaten to death.
Savagely
That's
beaten,
right.
Yes. The day that Gavin died, the liaison officer said to us outside the hospital it was only a matter of time before he would do something
God.
Like this.
Oh, my God.
And Jerry said back to him, and he's left him on the street, he murdered our innocent son.
They didn't even know each other. No reason for this crime whatsoever. None whatsoever.
And, okay, Gavin was at the music festival. He's a musician.
Yes.
In his car, asleep, the attack. When did you first hear about it?
10 to 7 on Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Gavin's girlfriend, Aoife, rang me and she said John McMahon, Gavin's friend, rang her and said that Gavin was gone to Drogheda Hospital in an ambulance, seriously injured. We headed straight for Drogheda, and on the way, Jerry's mobile rang and it was Carrick McCross Gardaí,
mm-hmm.
informed us that Gavin had been involved in a hit and run at Listoonan. And we couldn't understand what was he doing at Listoonan.
Yeah.
And when I got to the hospital, sure, we were told straight away Gavin wasn't going to make it.
Oh, God.
Gavin's friend John arrived and he came over and he said to me, there's something peculiar about this, because he was at the roadside.
Okay.
And he said Gavin had no shoes on him and they weren't on the roadside. Because Gavin's shoes were in his car.
And how did you then put the sequence of events together?
Well, for a long time we thought it was a hit and run.
Yeah.
I informed the guard at the hospital who actually drove the ambulance because the paramedics were needed in the back. And I informed him that Gavin's car was parked in Farney Street in Carrickmacross. I wasn't aware that the car had been stolen.
Mm-hmm.
And at one stage the liaison officer came to me and he said to me, what kind of shoes was Gavin wearing? And I said he was wearing white runners. And he said, oh, that's okay, they're in the car. And I ran after him and I said to him, what car? And he said, I can't tell you anything at the minute, Helena. There's an investigation going on and I can't tell you anything. And I said, you have to tell me something. What is going on? And he said to me, all I can tell you at the moment is that there is an incident with Gavin's car and something else.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually he came to us and he told us they had arrested a guy for the murder of our son.
And they arrested Conor McClelland because his friend
rang the Garda station,
yeah,
to report. Like, Conor McClelland went to Oliver's house.
Mm-hmm.
Oliver brought him in and Conor McClelland lay down on the couch and went to sleep, absolutely covered in Gavin's blood. And when he was asleep, Oliver rang the Gardaí.
Well, that was it was the right thing to do. It was the only thing he could do.
It was the only thing he could do, and he was the main witness at the trial.
Was he, yeah?
We just need this made public. We need parents to be aware and make their children aware of what can happen.
And in the court, Jerry, you mentioned it was, 2.5 weeks you felt... We missed that opening remark you made. You felt you were going into in and out of a sweet shop. There was just no...
There was no media presence whatsoever.
Okay.
We were wondering, was this what trials are like? Or does anybody know that
mm-hmm.
this is going on? Does anybody care? Were we supposed to ring somebody to say, our son's murder trial is going ahead now? You know, it was... Every day, it just drained the life out of us. Every day... There was new evidence coming out. Like, it was worse than we even thought it would be, you know. But again, we couldn't be told any of this before the trial because we wouldn't be supposed to know this. But as I said, we come home every evening, we'd be watching the news, we'd be hearing about all the other things and crimes that's committed, and ours, it's as if it never happened, you know.
And
we listen to the radio, we listen to it every day, absolutely nothing. We're wondering, did this happen at all or not? You know, we felt as if we were disowned. We don't matter. You know,
and the horror,
just ordinary people.
And because of the horror of it, and the way
the horror of it,
Gavin
is
was
not
killed.
Right, because the inside of the car was like a slaughterhouse. It was like a slaughterhouse. It was just destroyed. It was explained in court. The blood on the rocks, the different type of blood that there is that we don't know about, airborne blood, that blood squirting through the air, that's what was on Conor McClellan's face. The blood was squirting out of Gavin and hitting this guy in his face, and he still kept beating with rocks. This is nightmare stuff. It's like we're sick. We'll never be right again. But people should know that there's death and there's death and there's murder and there's murder, but it took Gavin 12 hours today from this assault. Well, he's never going to be coming
now,
back.
Now, Jerry, Gavin was in cardiac arrest when the ambulance got there, and it took them 40 minutes to restart his heart. And they stopped numerous times between Ustoon and Drogheda to restart it. And when we got to the hospital, the consultant told us that when Gavin came in, they did a scan on him, and that the only way he could describe it was that Gavin's brain should have had four compartments, but all he had was a big red mush. And that the only reason his heart was still beating was because he was so young and strong, and that when his heart started to slow down and stop, they would not be restarting it.
The accident would be like to see Gavin, and we said we would.
Yeah.
And they said, well, look, give us a half an hour till we clean him up a bit. He's not pretty, and you're going to see something like you've never seen in your life. But we'll tidy him up, and we'll give you a shout. Then they contacted us, bring us into the ward where he was, and they opened the door, and we seen this thing on the bed. We turned back. We'd never imagined nothing like it. You couldn't. So we went to go in a second time, and when we seen him, we couldn't. We turned back. Three attempts it took to go in. And when we went in and went up to him, you never seen anything like it in your life. His head was three times the size of what it should have been. And we were devastated. But something came over us. We knew it was Gavin.
Yeah.
We had his arm and it was warm, but his head was destroyed. It was shocking. Yeah. And all Gavin's friends were 50 plus outside the hospital all day long, and they opened the doors and let them in, and they all came in turn to poor Gavin. Despite the worst day of our life. The worst day of our life, he was this.
And
we'll never get over it. Never. You've seen the boy that left here on the Friday evening to what we've seen on the Saturday evening. It wasn't human what was done to him.
And to be just told fierce. To be told that with this man who killed him, Conor McLennan, that it was only a matter of time.
Yes.
Yeah.
19 years of age, nearly 20 previous convictions, including some for assault.
Yeah.
Yes.
He was obviously on the rampage through his teenage years, because that's when you gather up convictions.
Yeah.
And what when you met him in court and saw him in court?
He stared us out of it.
Oh, God.
Not at the trial, at the original courts in Carrickmacross. He just would stare at us. But at the trial, he most of the time sat looking at the floor. And the only time he lifted his head was when the CCTV coverage of himself was on. He watched it. But when the CCTV coverage of Gavin walking to the nightclub and walking back to his car came on, he looked at the floor again.
And did McLennan's defence offer any insight, information?
No, the defence never really cross-examined anybody. Barrister stood up for the closing speech and he said he was there to do a job because of the oath he took, that he wouldn't want to put another featherweight of pain on the O'Connor family.
Yeah.
We were the ones that got the phone call to say our boy wasn't coming home. But if you put the shoe on the other foot, McClellan's were the one that got the phone call to say their boy had done wrong. But he tried more or less a sympathy thing for him, I presume.
And
he would have tried to get him down to manslaughter. Uh-huh. Is what he would have tried to do. But he couldn't. You can't change the facts of what he'd done. And right up until the judge came out with a unanimous verdict of guilty of murder, McClellan believed he was going to get away with manslaughter. He was going to get away with manslaughter.
And as far as you know, Jerry and Helena, Jerry, was any of his family in court?
McClellan? Yes, his parents and brothers and sister and some aunts, I think, were in court.
Did they say anything?
No.
No.
They didn't.
Did they acknowledge you?
No.
No.
Like, Gavin died, we had been told we would get Gavin home on the Sunday night after the post-mortem. And then on the Sunday, we were told, because of the extent of his injuries, the post-mortem would take longer and we would have him home on Monday. And then on Monday we were told we wouldn't be getting him home because the defence wanted an independent post-mortem. So Gavin died on a Saturday, and we did not see Gavin again or get him home here until the Wednesday.
But I, given the glimpse that you've given us, and it's only a glimpse we could ever get into the pain that you are suffering.
There are no words to describe it.
But did the McLennan family not get a glimpse or empathise with that horror that you're going through?
Now, this is my opinion. I am in Monaghan Courthouse. I felt like we were the ones that did something wrong. I have to say, like, they just don't seem to care.
And were you aware of McLennan before this?
No. We'd never heard of him until he murdered Gavin.
And we presume he never knew Gavin. It was just
random. He said in his statement to the Gardaí when they were interviewing him, they asked him, did he know Gavin? And he said, no, he didn't have a clue who he was.
And did he offer any explanation as to why?
No explanation whatsoever. And in my opinion, has shown no remorse either.
He offered no explanation.
He told the Gardaí in one of the interviews that Gavin was doing his head in.
Gavin was asleep in a car.
Yeah, and Gavin was doing his head in, and that's why he hit him.
Yeah, Gavin was reported to have been saying, stop, stop, stop. That could have been when he was hitting him with the rocks. Or maybe when he was driving the car, Gavin might have started to wake up and was saying, stop, stop, stop.
That's all the words Gavin said.
Stop, stop, stop.
But did he offer any defence saying, I was insane, I was drunk,
drugged? The way he put it was, I'm a dope with drinking me. Maybe I shouldn't drink at all.
That sounds like somebody who fell off their bicycle after having a drink.
That's what he said, I'm a dope with drink. CCTV coverage of Gavin going back to his car at 3:20. Yes. And approximately an hour later, it showed him Conor McLellan leaving Duffy's car park and entering Farney Street from the opposite end where Gavin had entered. And yet he was walking straight, he was not staggering, he didn't look like somebody that was stone drunk.
Now, another tragedy, unfortunately, in the meantime. Gavin had
one brother.
And what happened?
Patrick was 33. He was a truck driver who drove around the country every day of the week in a big articulated truck. And on Saturday the 9th of November, Patrick headed up to Navan in his car, and we don't know what happened. He ended up losing control of the car, hit a pole and then hit a gate and was killed instantly.
That swooped him, took him on us in the middle of the day on a Saturday.
The Gardaí hadn't come back to us with the end of the investigation, so we have no idea.
We still don't know what happened.
To lose control.
So he never saw justice being done for his brother.
No, and he was adamant that justice would be done, and he was going to be with us throughout the trial. He was going to sit between us. Patrick was our rock from Gavin had died. He brought us through the death. He was always at the end of the phone. He only lived 3 miles away. You could ring him, and he'd be here in 10 minutes to you.
And now they're lying side by side.
We have one daughter left, and she's married and living in Australia with her husband and 2 children.
And in terms of what okay, there's the issue. By the way, I don't even know if you could even spot this, but what was in the papers and on the 6-1 news on the days of this trial?
Sorry, Joe, I didn't catch that.
So, Elena, sorry, what was in the newspapers and on the 6-1 news when the trial was going on and all these horrific details?
Well, the Anglo-Irish thing was going on in Dublin with Sean Fitzpatrick.
Started on the same day, the 4th, as far as we know.
The whole coverage on the news was about what was going on in Dublin.
And there was other court things about somebody in the Dáil sending in false phone bills and different things, and that seemed to be more important than our son's death. Phone bills, incorrect phone bills, politicians.
Like, in my opinion, every other murder trial gets big media coverage. But it's not that we want to be the centre of attention, but what happened to Gavin should have been worth a bit of media coverage. Like, when it happened, the weekend it happened, it was on the news, and, you know, it was
But would it? But would it be because it wasn't in my memory, Helena? And the reason I think is, was it characterised initially as a hit and run?
Yeah.
Not as a murder.
But it came into the papers as a murder.
Oh, did it? Okay.
It did. Yeah. For us, it started off with Gavin was in an accident. To Gavin was in a hit and run. To Gavin being assaulted. To being upgraded then to a murder.
Yeah. But it was RTÉ News at the time had it. Like, they showed it on the news, and they showed, like, it was on the news, seemingly on the Saturday night. It showed McClelland appearing in the court in Calb, and on the Sunday night. Like, RTÉ did run it on the news for a few days. Like,
3 years
the actual event when it happened got media coverage. The trial was supposed to be in February last year, and a week before it was due to start, it was adjourned.
And at no stage... And but you never said, please, media, leave us in privacy.
No,
or...
no, never.
Okay, because people do respect that, you know.
No,
that
we
people...
never did.
Okay,
no.
Okay.
And they were expecting big media coverage because we had been told there would be big media coverage at this
but
trial.
But the reason you want to bring it to attention is the fact, one, of the horror of what happened to your boy,
yes.
And two, the fact that McClelland had so many previous convictions,
yeah.
Up to 19 years of age.
And he was still walking the street. Yeah, like, in all fairness, Joe, somebody with that amount of conviction should not have been on the street.
And when the convictions were, I presume they were then presented to the judge when he was found guilty. And were they, I know you mentioned, were there many assault charges or was it all?
Well, you see, any of the convictions he had before he was 18 could not be mentioned. So the 21 convictions were in the year from he was 18 to 19.
He was getting nearly 2 convictions a month.
Yeah. Like numerous times before he was charged with the murder. We'd be in court in Carrickmacross every month, and he'd always be up for something else as well. Along with assault, it was assault, and he was charged with first, and then in the September 2011, he was charged with murder. But every single time he was in court, he nearly was called up on something else as well. And even the day he was charged with the murder, he was up on some other conviction, and the judge said to him, "Oh, I remember you." He said, "I'll actually be charging you with murder later in the court."
And was he getting...
When he was charged with murder, he was asked how did he plead, and that was the first time you heard him speaking. He says, "Not guilty. Not guilty."
Even though the evidence was overwhelming.
As I said, detectives, I have to say, in all fairness, they'd done some investigation, because it takes an awful lot of investigation and evidence to be handed over to the DPP for them to go through it, to come back, to charge a man with murder. You just don't do it. You have to have everything right. And they seen what they had, and whether it took them 2 months or 3, when they gathered all the information and the evidence, they said, "This man murdered Gavin O'Connor. We have to charge him with murder."
And you this know, man, his friend, or well, he...
He would have been... He wouldn't have really been a friend.
Okay,
would have been a person he knew.
Well, McClelland would have characterised him as a friend, but thankfully he turned out to be a decent, honourable man.
But you know something, Joe?
A guy like this has no friends.
Before he actually assaulted Gavin, he rang a guy from Gavin's phone, and he told him he was after stealing a car with a guy asleep in the back of it, and if he wakens up, I will have to hit him with a rock. And the guy told him to leave the car back where he got it, and he said, "I can't because my fingerprints are all over it."
And he'd done that before he assaulted Gavin.
And he told the Gardaí that he ran Gavin down to cover his tracks and make it look like a hit-and-run accident.
And people know of horrific murders, but this is...
Well, I think it's one of the most horrific murders that ever happened.
Shocking. It's shocking. It was described in court as chilling. It put a shiver down your spine. Only to think of it. Never mind go through it. To think about it. You couldn't do it. Not even for a movie could you even do anything like it. Desperate.
And had McClelland,
many times he'd hit him with each rock. I'd be counting that for the rest of my life. How many times? What was Gavin's last words? Did he cry for his mother or his daddy or his girlfriend? What was going through his mind as he was being senselessly battered with rocks, shocking, desperate? There's no tablet for this pain that we're going through. There's nothing. We just have to live through it day after day. Yes.
And Helene, when they read out McLennan's previous convictions, and they, as you say, they were only for a year, 21 in 1 year, including assault. Had he gone to prison in that year?
He had a suspended prison sentence. At the time of Gavin's murder, he was on probation and community service. And at one of the courts, his probation officer stood up and asked for him to be excused from community service because he wasn't available to do it. Twice during the court, he was sentenced to 2 or 3 months imprisonment for something else. You know, and like, he's going to walk out of the prison eventually, and he'll still be a young enough man to carry on with his life, Joe. We have a life sentence that we'll never get rid of.
And do people, because, as you say, he didn't get national coverage, I presume it got local coverage?
It got local coverage in the local paper. Yeah. The local radio station knew nothing about it either.
But I presume,
all it got was coverage in the Northern Standard paper. They covered the trial for the 3 weeks. It was in their paper, the 3 weeks. And then there was a little bit in the Meath Chronicle. And then after the trial, the Star newspaper rang us.
Okay.
And they did a print out. Okay. And we were rang by the local radio station, and we did an interview on it the following week.
Yeah.
And then I decided here, I have to get this made public. So I did up an email, and I emailed it to absolutely everybody and anybody I could think of that might help us to make it public.
That's how we got that this morning. But in terms of the future, okay, what might emerge now, which is one of the reasons why these cases should get massive publicity, is because, one, the horror of what McLennan did. Two, is there other stuff he did in different parts of the country that people are unaware of at this stage? And three is to remind our legislators and our law enforcers that if somebody has 21 charges in 12 months, there is something, as you were told, it was only a matter of time. So what can be done in the future to stop this?
Let all teenagers be aware that they're not invincible. You don't know what can happen to you. Like, Gavin O'Connor left here that Friday night, happy as Larry, and he never came back home. Never. And as I say, he socialised in Carrickmacross all his teenage life. So I'm sure it wouldn't have been the first time he slept in his car either.
And also let people, if there are people like McLennan, which we hope there aren't, let them know that they will get no succour, no refuge, even from people who they think are their so-called friends.
True. And but like, had Gavin drove home, Joe, with the drink in him and been killed, it would have been an awful lot easier to accept than what has happened. We will never accept the way Gavin died.
Yeah.
Like, he did the right thing. He went to sleep in the back of his car because he had been drinking.
He had so much to live for, our Gavin. He had an awful lot to give to the country. Musically wise, he was very talented. It breaks our heart now. I'd be on the road driving and there comes a song on the radio and I have to pull over and cry. Can't do anything about it. And then turn off the radio and carry on driving. Or likewise, I'm driving along the road next to see a truck. It reminds me of Patrick. But I can't turn off the trucks. Just drive on, cry. That's just the way it is. Can't do anything about it.
And did you speak at any stage, Gerry or Helene, to this man Oliver who rang the Gardaí?
Yes. Oliver at the trial, I gave Oliver a hug and I thanked him for ringing the Gardaí and for doing what he did. And the answer Oliver gave me was, I was no saint myself, I was in trouble with the guards myself, but I wasn't going to do something like that. Yeah. And we will always appreciate Oliver for being brave enough to ring the Gardaí.
Okay, stay with us, Gerry and Helena, please, because somebody wants to talk to you after this break. 51551. Michael, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe?
You were covering the trial.
I was covering the trial for the local newspaper in Monaghan, which is the Northern Standard, and we did cover it extensively.
Of course,
Now, it's true that there didn't seem to be there seemed to be a very low level of interest from the national media. I was surprised, first of all, that there wasn't other people, and we weren't scrambling for places even to report it. But I did send daily updates to national newspapers, all national newspapers, not every national newspaper every day, but they were given regular updates either via myself directly or via a colleague who regularly reports. But it didn't seem to be breaking the ice, which I found very surprising given the sort of the harrowing nature and very unusual nature of the case, because it was a horrendous case. I was told by my colleague that some of them were saying that they were waiting until the actual verdict came along, which is not, you know, normally you will get daily updates on murder trials or big trials like that. But even when the verdict did come along, there was a very, very little sort of uptake at that stage either. So I was surprised, but we were doing our best. And as I say, I was concentrating on my own local paper at the same time, Joe.
And one of the things, Michael, and I think you'll understand this, that Helena and Jerry feel, from what they said here today, is that the import and the horror of what was visited on young Gavin and their family, they wanted people to know this. I'm sure you sitting there could see through the evidence, as you said, this was a very, very horrific case.
It certainly was. And I think that part of the problem seems to be, or what seems to have come out of this, is that the national media are not used to the idea of cases of this level, or murder cases being held anywhere other than in the Central Criminal Court. And they're used to getting their reports from the media franchise that operates from the CCC. So I just have a feeling that they thought, well, we're not so sure of reports coming from somewhere. I can't understand it because, I mean, I've had lots of reports of far less import and, you know, no bother getting them into papers down through the year. So I was a wee bit perplexed by the whole thing myself. It just wasn't. Now, whether it was to do with other stuff to do with Anglo-Irish trials or whatever, I just find it hard. It was getting no column inches anywhere, and you know, I felt bad about it, but we were doing our best, and as I say, we had to concentrate on our own end of it as well. You know, it was a horrific case. I felt a certain rapport with Gavin myself, because I was a sort of used to play rock music myself in bands. I've seen videos of him playing even the same songs we used to play, and you felt that, and it all the way through it, every bit of new evidence that came out, you know, it was bad. There was, you know, there was no sunlight in this at all. It was a terrible case, and there was no explanation for it, or there was no reason. It made no sense or rhyme or reason, or, you know, it's probably the right of the defence, but their man never went into the box, so there was never any explanation given as to why he might have done this. It didn't make any sense at all.
And had you ever come across in your work Conor McClelland before?
I hadn't, because I think I would be dealing a lot with the courts in Monaghan Town. Conor was he'd be more down in the Carrickmacross end of the county. It's almost like it's a difference. So, and I would imagine also that a lot of the previous convictions mentioned would have happened during the time he would have been a juvenile, which a lot of those cases don't come to radar at all, because even if you're reported, you can't give the name. So, we knew even while the trial was going on that he had certain previous convictions, and as you know, they couldn't be mentioned even during reporting, during the thing. But I didn't realise he had as many, but there was nothing of anything like the scale of what happened. Even anything he had done before came nowhere to explaining what happened that night.
And were you aware of, did Conor McClelland say anything to you, or his family say anything by way of remorse or upset or?
No, I didn't have any. I wouldn't, in that context, I wouldn't be looking to be talking to basically anyone. We'd be just basically reporting what's happening in the. There was, you know, Conor, as Helena said, basically sat in his suit and looking at the ground throughout. There was certainly no contact that I could see between either of the two families. And it was a terrible, almost surreal situation. But it was a strange thing that there was no media presence at all, apart from myself, almost the whole way through, and it was 2 weeks, non-stop.
Irene Murphy is, I think, Irene. Good afternoon, and I know you want to empathise and offer your sympathies and condolences to Helena and Jerry.
That's even too simple, Joe, to even say it. I'm not knocking what you're saying, but just to put you in the picture, I'm actually out in Shangana. That's the graveyard. Yeah. I'm sure you know it out in Shankill here. And I'm at my son's graveside. He committed suicide 9 years ago. And, you know, I come here a couple of times a week. Joe, can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear, Irene.
Yeah, it's just a bloody phone.
It's
just going to go any second. But however, I sit here week after week and I think, oh my God, my life, and how can I try to carry on for my children? But having heard that couple, Joe, I really cannot tell you how brokenhearted I am for them. And I can honestly say that I can say now that there is worse than what happened to Lorcan.
To your
boy. I'm so sorry for them.
Yeah.
I really am.
Oh, I'm still on.
Jerry is still there. That's Jerry.
Helena's phone went flat, I think.
Okay,
I know. I think, Jerry, mine will go flat as well, too. But I want you to know that I am feeling so deeply for you. I've never heard such, oh, my God, the inhumanity. That's just the word for it, the inhumanity.
And you're representative.
And
you're representative, Irene, of so many other callers as well, saying
well,
the
I'm,
same
I'm,
thing.
I'm glad I am. And if it's, maybe it's a shocking thing to say, but in a certain way, it's not nice to say this, but they've actually helped me. Because I've been sitting here for 9 years, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Thinking, oh my God, how terrible this is. But Lorcan decided to do what he did, of his own volition, do you know?
And what age was Lorcan, Irene?
When it happened?
Yeah.
He was 34, Joe.
Yeah, okay.
A chartered engineer, everything going from fabulous apartment in Australia, you know, but however, that's neither here nor there. Well, I don't mean it's here, of course, it's here or there, but I just want to, you know, just tell those people that, I'm actually lost for words. I don't think I've ever.
But you can sense their isolation in terms of one.
Thank you very much. Their
other boy, as Jerry and Helena pointed out, Patrick was killed as well, and their daughter's in Australia.
Jerry, I just don't know how you get out of bed in the morning. I truly don't, because
we don't know either. We hold hands each evening, and we say, "How did we get this far?" We don't know. You just have to get up and carry on.
I really, Jerry, I just, at this point, I have no more words to say to you. But just such deep. And I'm glad to say that Joe has just said there that other people are trying to get on to say this as well, too. That you know that you have the sympathy of the nation. I've never heard such indifference in my entire life about any.
Thank you very, very much.
Not at all, Jerry, and your good wife, Lena.
We're not alone. We're not alone. There's loads of other people out there the same as us.
Yeah.
But I feel sorry for the next person that's going to get the phone call, because I don't think it's going to stop.
No, unfortunately, we seem to be living in a life like this. And really, if your son comes home in one piece after a night in the town, you're just relieved. It's a terrible thing to say, but it is a fact of life.
Yeah, it is.
So, Jerry, I leave yourself and Helena now, and always, when I'm out here with Lorcan now, I'll think of you as well, too, and your
darling.
Thank
you very much.
Bye-bye, Jerry.
Okay, that's a lovely,
Thank you very much.
A lovely sentiment, Irene, and condolences to you
Irene.
On Lorcan's passing. Jerry, tell just finally, Gavin was a musician.
Yes.
And Michael said he saw him on video, so somebody videoed him, so he must have been good. He liked his music, obviously.
He loved his music, Joe, and it wasn't until he was dead and his friend John came over here. We went up to his room. Gavin kind of set up his room like a recording studio. He had brand new equipment he bought with his money because he was working away, and he recorded three songs. And we didn't know, and because he'd do it during the day when we'd be away at work. And he'd done three lovely recordings. One was Jack and Diane, one was Sunny Afternoon, and then he was doing one for Santa's Coming to Town for the grandkids. And it breaks our heart to hear the song. He's just like the originals. We might send you a copy of one of them.
Do, absolutely. He sounds like a gorgeous, gorgeous boy, and a very talented boy as well.
Very talented. Joe, he had long hair as well, and he looked the part, and everybody loved him. Everybody loved him. He had so many friends. He didn't have one enemy that we'd know of. No. As a matter of fact, Conor McLeod, it wasn't even his enemy because he didn't even know him.
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
He didn't even know Gavin from Adam. Just cruel, cruel, cruel.
Well, Gerry and Alina, thank you so much for raising the issue. I know that was your aim, and you've made it clear why you wanted people to know about it. There's nothing else I can say.
Well, thank you, Joe.
Well, Joe, the way it is with me, unless we air it now, this fella could have gone to prison as if he robbed a sweet shop. Nobody would know any difference.
Yeah.
But he didn't rob a sweet shop. He'd done one of the worst crimes that could be committed in the state. Horrific crime. So thank you, Joe, for giving us our time.
Well, may Gavin rest in peace.
Thank you.
Very much. Safe, I hope, in the arms of his brother.
Well, I hope so too, Joe. I hope so, and hopefully we'll join them too at some stage.
But may all the blessings that if you could read the text, Gerry and Alina coming in, and if they were just a grain of sand, I know it's a horrid desert of grief you're going through, but if they were just a grain of sand to try and salve your wound, it might help. But I know your wound is too... It's just too deep. But so many people have so much sympathy and so much empathy and a sense of trying to reach out to you across the airwaves. And I know you hold each other's hands each evening, and so many people are holding your hands now.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Thank you, Joe.
51551 is our text number. Jane Woods is on the line. Jane, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Jean, sorry.
Jean, yes. Is there a mobile phone on nearby, or is there another interference there in some shape or form?
No.
Okay. You're a psychotherapist. You're listening to Gerry and Alina, but I think they brought up a wider issue of how families cope with grief over a long period.
Yes. Well, I'm a psychotherapist, Joe, yes. My specialised area would be bereavement, grief, loss, and I've been working in this area accredited since the late 80s, so I have a lot of experience, plus personal experience of bereavement and grief and all that goes with it. Yes, it's wide and varied. The story that they told, it was the pain, the rawness of, I think what was coming through to me was the disbelief. And there's no two families grieve the same way. There's no two family members grieve the same way. And that can cause great confusion and further pain on top of the pain of the grief. There's no one way to grieve. That's what I'd love people to hear. There's no one way. There's no right way.
There's no right way.
There's no wrong way. It's the individual. It's my way. This is the way I am. You know, a wife can have a day maybe where it's okay.
Yeah.
And the husband or the partner is down in the depths. So that's difficult.
And when you're, like, can you understand Gerry and Alina's point? And we know it was the way of the world, unfortunately, and there was no conspiracy among the media not to cover the case, but the fact that they really, as you heard, genuinely felt that what happened to their son deserved to be national news, and the country deserved to know about the horrors that were inflicted. Can you understand that cry from them, that they want people?
Yeah. Well, in their charity, I suppose, in their compassion, and out of their own pain, it's to, I suppose, try and protect others, maybe is what they're at. You know, the loss is so huge for them. They've lost their two sons. They've lost, you know, kind of, how do you live with that? So it's like, people, the number of times I've been asked over the years, you know, when will we be back to normal, Jean? How long does it take to get back to normal? And I explain to people, it's not the normal you knew. And it's adjusting to the new normal. That's life without your son, your daughter, your loved one. And that's the pain. It's like a bridge from the old normal, walking, journeying on a bridge to the new normal without the person, without their beautiful son, or sons in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Heartbreaking. And it'll take as long as it takes. You know, and I heard the dad saying...
Jerry,
I heard him saying, we'll never get over this. You know, we'll never accept it, I think, actually, was what he might have said. Yeah. And, you know, I don't think, in my experience, I would never expect anyone to accept, whether it's a murder or horrific death, traumatic, whatever it is, the other lady at the graveside. Terribly, terribly sad. It's been asked to accept or coming to a place, moving towards a place where it's like, I now have learned to accept that I am without my beautiful son, my beautiful daughter, my husband, my wife, my baby. So it's not accepting the horrificness of the death. Do you understand?
And people what you're saying, you accept. I don't know if it's a radio or something on in the background, but that buzzing. But what you're saying, Jean, is so important. What you're saying is, this is a new situation you're in. You're not saying it's you know, when Jerry was saying, I got the sense that they felt, where is the hope? Their two boys are gone. One in horrific circumstances, another in a road accident. And
which nearly minimises the road accident, in a sense, because it's seen as an ordinary death, isn't it?
Yeah, and also you heard Irene from her son, Larkin, Irene Murphy from her son's graveside, saying somehow it diluted, which is the wrong word to use, but it diluted slightly her pain.
Yes.
Because she realised the horror that Jerry and Helena and Gavin, of course, went through was just unspeakable.
So it shows you the gift of sharing.
But people do look for... Do they say how long will it take? What do they... When they come...
It's more or less, when will this be over? When will I be over this? And I always say to people, you don't get over grief. You learn to live with it. Or some people don't learn to live with it. That's the journey. That's the advantage of bereavement support groups or... bereavement counselling, therapy, you know, whatever. And there's many, many people, Joe, never, ever, ever have to go to a therapist. Or I know when
course,
I was growing up, there was no such thing. It was family. And even today, there's families do it, you know, among themselves. They get through with the support of family, extended family, neighbours, friends, you know, yourself. And then there are people, you know, who need more than they're getting.
Yeah.
For so many reasons. Like, I could talk forever to you.
And, Jean, when people come into you and they do they say to you, like, can you help us through our grief?
Well, that's what they're saying. But it's supporting them through their grief.
Okay.
You see, it's self-care, Joe. There's so many people. They've gone through hell. Hell and back, sometimes. And they don't even kind of... When I say to people... You know, I'm going to say something to you now. Slow down. Their head is so full of everything. And they want to get it out all in one. And I said, just slow, take your time. Slow down. And then before the first or second session, I'd be huge on helping themselves. In a sense, taking good care of yourself now. Because you cannot give. Say, like, the mother or father, how can you give to your other children? Or support anyone else when you can't support yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so it's about diet and exercise, walking. You'd think I was minister for walking. In a sense, I'd say, like, it's free. Walk. And you get your thoughts and your head together and, you know,
but
just looking after themselves. begin to the rest of my life.
But then Jerry's pain and Helena's pain, they would say, Jerry said, I drive, I see trucks, I think of my brother, of my son, Patrick.
Yeah,
I turn on the radio, I hear a bit of music that Gavin, the talented musician, would have sung or played.
And that will be, that's the way it will be forever, for anybody.
Okay.
It'll be maybe a kind word. You meet somebody, they say, I knew him at school, and he was whatever. And they tell the story, and you're delighted to hear it, and it saddens you. And the other thing I would say to you, if people could realise the gift of tears, let the tears flow. Tears are healing. It's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of maturity.
But Jane, people
try not to live in the future, the present. Just day by day, maybe hour by hour. Just slow down. You know, right now. Just the present moment. And that's where somebody can come in and support a couple or a family. An individual, whatever, at their pace, just wherever they are at. Come out of the head and stay with the feelings. Just, I am sad today.
Yeah.
I'm very lonely. There's no stigma attached to being very lonely.
But I think the enduring image, and you've touched on it there, Jean, the enduring image from there, and the fact that the two of them wanted to speak together in different parts, they were obviously in different extensions in the house when they contacted.
And Joe, perhaps you today maybe are the first ones that they felt comfortable with, or maybe they have never spoken as much about it.
But the enduring image is not obviously of what young Gavin went through when he was murdered by that man, McLennan. But the other image is the two of them, Jerry and Helena, holding hands every evening.
Yeah.
As you said.
They're helping each other.
Yeah, yeah.
They need each other.
And there is so much out there, but it is, let no one, and they communicated it and articulated it so well, the pain that families go through because of mindless violence is
but
just unbearable.
But Joe, it's terribly important. It's terribly important for me to say, I often... For months and months and months, carried the flag of hope for people when they can't even get a glimpse of it for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and then I willingly give it back to them. It's about re-empowering a person, but it's very, very gentle. You know, it's compassionate. It's about being there for somebody where they're at any given time. It's not lifting somebody out prematurely, trying to move them on, and it never happened. And it takes as long as it takes.
Okay.
But there is a time when healing can take place very gently, and they will never forget, but they live parallel with it. You know what I mean?
I think you put it across brilliantly, Jean, and I really appreciate it. That's Jean Woods, who's a psychotherapist, but a rock of sense, as you heard. And again, the condolences and the calls about Jerry and Helena O'Connor and about their dear sons, Gavin and Patrick.